Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 341 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In this podcast, I'm going to be talking about lupus and the USMLEs. For those of you that have ever taken the USMLE exams, you know that lupus is a very well-represented fixture. It's something that just loves to pop up on exams. So it's something that you absolutely should know as much as is humanly possible about. So that's why I decided to make a podcast that is entirely focused on lupus. Now, for those of you that are studying for the USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3 exams, or, you know, Complex Level 2 or 3, I do have a review course coming up in about 2 weeks. It starts with an MBME Test Taking Strategies course that's taking place on the 4th of October from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then I have a review course that goes from the 5th to the 8th of October. It's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on all four of those days. Again, I've had tons of people attend these courses. I get emails all the time from people that have attended them and done really well and passed the exams, crushed the exams, get like really high scores on the exams. So again, if you see that you're struggling with the material, you're struggling to raise your scores, I would strongly encourage you to join the course. So just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. You're not going to be getting stock lectures. You're going to be getting about 2,000 different concepts discussed primarily by way of clinical vignettes. Again, I've had many people attend these courses and do really well with them. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. So lupus, right? So we know that, you know, lupus is not great, right? It's not an ideal disease to have. And one of the reasons, in fact, let me tell you this. One thing that one nebulous section of the USMLE exams that people struggle to prepare for is the portion that's called multi-system processes and disorders, right? Look at that term, multi-system processes and disorders. It's basically a part of the exam that focuses on disorders that have like multiple systemic manifestations, right? So lupus is a great disease for those kinds of problems, right? So because lupus cuts across many body systems, it affects the lungs, it affects the skin, affects your joints, affects your hematologic system, affects your brain, affects just many, many different things, right? So that's just one of those big high yield things to keep in mind. That's why they love to test it on the exams, right? And again, remember, most times when you see a person that has, I'm going to basically try to cover lupus from every possible angle in this podcast, although it should be a short podcast, right? But the first thing I think I want to emphasize is that when you see lupus on an MBM exam, it's likely going to be in a female, okay? So the thing is, paying attention to demographics helps quite a bit on the USMLEs, right? So if you see a female having problems, right, you're probably thinking more lupus, right? It's very unusual for a guy to have lupus on a USMLE exam. And remember, most times the people that have lupus on MBME exams tend to not be Caucasians, right? Tend to not be white people, right? Tends to be people that are like African American, people that have black heritage, people that are Asian, right? Those are people that tend to have lupus. Lupus, again, is very uncommon in Caucasians. I'm not saying it cannot, right? So that's why you need to consider other pieces of information given in the question. But lupus classically does not affect men and classically does not affect Caucasians on the USMLE exams, right? And again, it's kind of important to remember that lupus has certain HLA associations, right? So like HLA-A1, HLA-DR3, right? Those are kind of like the classic ones. I'm saying that especially for those that are studying for the USMLE Step 1 exam that are listening to this podcast. Now, the big thing is, in terms of lupus pathophysiology, is just understanding, why do these people have these systemic problems? Well, they have these systemic problems for, I would say, like one primary reason. So ultimately, there's like two mechanisms that underlie lupus and all the badness that happens, right? But I would say that one of the primary reasons behind the systemic effects, right, is from a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. Basically, the thing that happens is that you form immune complexes, right? So like, for example, many of us have heard of, oh, in lupus, there's like anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, right? So basically, that the thing that happens is DNA, right? You make antibodies against it, right? Those are the anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, right? So DNA has antibodies made against it, and then they pair up, right? And then when they pair up, they form an immune complex, right? It's an antigen-antibody complex. And then they go and start depositing in different parts of the body. And as they deposit in those different parts of the body, they cause a lot of chaos. They cause a lot of inflammation, right? So that's why you see the symptoms are so disparate, right? Like, for example, those things can go to the joints, because remember, antibodies, especially like IgG and IgM, have the ability to activate a complement. So the thing is, they just show up, right, in a part of the body, recruit complement there, and just cause a lot of damage. That's why complement is typically low in many antecedents of lupus, right? So say, for example, if a person has like diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, which is like the big NBME renal manifestation of lupus, those people will have low complement, right? That's actually a very high yield thing to know, right? The mechanism behind that low complement is from the immune complexa deposits, right? So ultimately, you have a big decrement in your complementar proteins. So those immune complexes, they can deposit in your joints, they can cause problems there. They can deposit on serosal surfaces, especially like the surface of like the pleura, right? They can cause like a serositis, they can cause a pleuritis, they can cause pleurisy, right? They can deposit on your pericardial wall, they can cause a pericarditis, right? They can deposit in the kidneys, they can cause like lupus nephritis, right? Again, the reason you're hearing all these itises is because essentially the thing that happens is these things, they show up somewhere, they form an immune complex, cause a lot of complement recruitment, and that causes a lot of damage. But one special branch of lupus I think I would want you to know about are basically the cytopenias that accompany lupus, right? So the thing is, in lupus, in many cases, you do make autoantibodies against like elements of your hematologic system. So you can make autoantibodies against your red blood cells, right? That'll be like an autoimmune hemolytic anemia. Obviously, the Coombs test will be positive in those people. You can make autoantibodies against platelet proteins like GP2B3A. That's going to give you immune thrombocytopenia, right? You can make antibodies against your white blood cells, right? You can have an autoimmune leukopenia, right? The thing is, in these cases, because you are making autoantibodies against like fixed cells in the body, right? These are examples of type 2 hypersensitivity reactions. I'll say that again. These are examples of type 2 hypersensitivity reactions. So again, the primary pathogenesis behind disease and immune complexes, those are type 3 hypersensitivity reactions. But the cytopenias that people get in lupus are actually examples of type 2 hypersensitivity reactions, right? So again, what are the classic findings in lupus on NBM exams? Again, you know, these people have like fever, they'll have a Miller rash, right? That's usually, they usually have like a rash on their face, right? And obviously, we all know the buzzword that you'll spare the nasolabial folds, right? It will spare the nasolabial folds. And it's very high yield to know that those dermatologic findings tend to worsen with sun exposure. Right? Those dermatologic findings, they tend to worsen with sun exposure, right? There are just many different things the NBMEs love to put with lupus, right? Like they can have this Miller rash, they can have joint pain, right? I'll talk about that joint pain in a little bit more detail, right? They can have joint pain, they can have serositis like pleurisy or pleuritis, they can have pericarditis, they can have these autoimmune cytopenias, they can have many of those different things, right? So I think maybe let's break them down one by one, right? So let's kind of start with the joints, right? So the thing is, it's actually very high yield to know that lupus can cause a specific kind of arthropathy, right? And the thing is, we know our friends at the NBMEs, right? They love to mix and match things up. The way they love to mix and match things up is to make you think that, ooh, I'm looking at rheumatoid arthritis, but you're actually not looking at rheumatoid arthritis. So let me explain this, right? So people that have a lupus arthropathy or lupus arthritis, right? They will have morning stiffness just like the regular people that have rheumatoid arthritis. But there are certain key differences that should help you delineate lupus arthritis from rheumatoid arthritis. So we know that in rheumatoid arthritis, the joint damage is asymmetric. That's very high yield to know. In rheumatoid arthritis, the damage is usually asymmetric, right? But in lupus, the damage is usually symmetric. Although again, let me say this. In certain cases, the damage in rheumatoid arthritis can be symmetric, right? So let me backtrack a bit. In rheumatoid arthritis, the joint damage can be symmetric or asymmetric. But in lupus, it is classically symmetric. Now, in rheumatoid arthritis, the joint, the arthritis you have is usually erosive. Like you literally have joint damage. You literally have damage to the joints. But in lupus arthritis, the joints actually spick and span, right? The arthritis is completely non-erosive. You don't have erosion of the joint in lupus arthritis. And then many times, people that have rheumatoid arthritis, they tend to just have joint deformities, again, from all the joint damage. People that have lupus, in general, their joint deformity is usually non-deforming. right? And the thing is, we know rheumatoid arthritis, you know, affects the hands, affects the knees, affects the hips, affects many parts of the body. People that have lupus arthritis, it almost always on NBMEs is going to be in the hands, right? But again, it will be on the hands in a rheumatoid distribution. Many times you're going to have problems in the MCPs, right? Like your knuckles, basically. And also your the PIPs, right? So the MCPs and the PIPs. It kind of, again, looks like a rheumatoid arthritis distribution. And then, remember, these people, if we're going to the skin findings, right, many times they will have this rash. And again, it's going to worsen with sun exposure, right? So if on NBME exams, they give you a question about a person that has a rash, and the rash seems to worsen when they go on the beach, you really want, that's like a very specific finding many times on NBME exams in lupus, right? In lupus. Now, they tell you that this person develops this rash after they go on some summer vacation, right? Many times that should tell you that you're very likely dealing with lupus, especially when the rash is on the face, okay? Especially when the rash is on the face. And I think one thing I want to go ahead and mention here is people that have a malar rash don't always have lupus on NBME exams, right? So again, the NBMEs, many times they love to conflate lupus and sarcoidosis on an NBME exam, right? So if you see an African-American woman that has many antecedents of sarcoidosis, like the interstitial lung disease, hypercalcemia, elevated angiotensin converting enzyme levels, hyalur lymphadenopathy, and you notice that she has a malar rash, I want you to think of something called lupus pernio. Right? Lupus pernio. Pernio is spelled P-E-R-N-I-O, right? Lupus pernio. That's like the malar rash finding in people that have sarcoidosis. Remember, that is not the only dermatologic finding of sarcoidosis, right? In the lower extremities, people that have sarcoid, they can have this painful circular erythematous rash, right? That's the thing we call an erythema nodosum, right? So those are just two classic dermatologic findings of sarcoidosis you want to keep in mind for your exam. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has lupus and you notice that, wow, over a few days, that creatinine starts bumping a lot and they have like hematuria? Well, if you see this, I really want you to think of them having lupus nephritis, right? And, you know, classically on NBME exams, sometimes they may not just put lupus nephritis. They may just put the name. They may put like diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, right? Diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis. Now, let me go ahead and say something here. One very high yield thing to know is whenever you see a person and you suspect they have lupus nephritis and they ask you for your next best step in diagnosis, you always want to get a renal biopsy. You always want to get a renal biopsy. Because here's the thing, there's multiple types of lupus nephritis. I remember learning this in med school, there's about 5 or 6 types, at least that were thought at Hopkins, of lupus nephritis, right? All those different types of lupus nephritis, right? You do need to know exactly what you're dealing with before you start treatment, right? So I will encourage you in general, don't start empiric treatment of lupus nephritis without having done some kind of renal biopsy, right? You need to do some kind of renal biopsy, right? And back in the day, lupus nephritis was actually the most common cause of death in lupus. But thankfully, that's no longer the case. These days, people that have lupus, most commonly they die of a cardiovascular disease. I'll say that right now, actually. The most common cause is very high yield. The most common cause of death in patients with lupus is cardiovascular disease. Again, back in the day, it was also like infection, but that is less likely as a cause of death these days. So I'll say it again with confidence. The most common cause of death in people that have lupus is cardiovascular disease, right? It is cardiovascular disease. And remember, again, lupus can affect the heart in 2 big ways, right? On NBME exams, right? Remember, again, all that inflammation can cause those people to have these, where they have sterile vegetations, right? Especially on the mitral valve. Many times they'll have the murmur of mitral regurg, right? That's what we call Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis, right? Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis. Again, those immune complexes can cause damage, pretty extensive damage to the mitral valve leaflets, right? So they can get a mitral regurg and that can present as Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis. Now remember, lupus, again, those immune complexes can deposit in the walls of the pericardium, right? And those people can get some kind of pericarditis. Right? Again, basically, whenever you have any serosal surface in the body, lupus can attack that serosal surface, right? So they can have like inflammation of the walls of the heart, right? That'll be pericarditis. They can have inflammation of the walls of the lungs. That can be pleuritis. Many times pleuritis, sometimes they may not put pleuritis as an answer, they may put pleurisy. But the big thing, right, is it's a serosal surface, pleural surface, pericardial surface, that these things tend to inflame. And many times, those things respond beautifully to NSAIDs, right? NSAIDs are the primary treatment. And maybe let me say this, because many of us know the way pericarditis presents, you know, chest pain, that is worse when you lay back, gets better when you lean forward. But pleuritis, let me tell you this, these are people that have chest pain that varies with respiration, not with the heartbeat. It varies with respiration, right? So when they're taking a deep breath, they almost have to like pause because of the lancinating pain that they are going through. When you see something like that, I really want you to think of pleuritis. Again, sometimes they may call that pleurisy on MBME exams, right? And then don't forget, right, in women that are pregnant, lupus can cause recurring pregnancy losses, right? Because again, that inflammation can begin to cause thrombosis of the uteroplacental artery. I'll say that again. That inflammation can cause thrombosis of the uteroplacental artery, right? So that's basically the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, right? So you make those, you damage the utero, you cause thrombotic episodes of the uteroplacental artery. Obviously, the baby is not going to be perfused properly, right? And that baby will likely die, right? And then another thing that can also happen that you should kind of keep in mind is people that have lupus, right, they can make these antibodies, right? They are antibodies you find in Sjogren's, right? So the anti-Rho antibodies, right? So those are the anti-SSA antibodies. Or they can make the anti-La antibodies. Those are the anti-SSB antibodies. And those antibodies have the ability to cross the placenta. They are IgG antibodies, right? So since they are IgG antibodies, they can absolutely cross the placenta. When they cross the placenta, they can damage the conducting system in the fetus. And when they damage the conducting system in the fetus, that's going to cause a third degree heart block, not second degree, third degree heart block. Remember, that's also called a complete heart block, right? Those are things that can absolutely happen. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient was recently started on some medication for an AVRT, nodal like reentrant tachycardia as a young patient. And then they tell you that, this patient starts having pleurisy, having all these arthralgias, having these fevers. If you see this, I absolutely want you to think about drug-induced lupus, right? Drug-induced lupus. Remember, drug-induced lupus are associated with antihistone antibodies, right? They're associated with antihistone antibodies. Many times, right, the drugs that are implicated here are going to be things like hydralazine, right? So they can give you an antihypertensive question, sulfonamides, right? So they can give you a question about a person that has HIV, right? And he's on prophylaxis for pneumocystis jervetz. Remember, we use sulfonamides there, right? Trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? Or if a person is being treated for toxoplasmosis, remember, we treat toxoplasmosis with pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine. Those are examples of sulfonamides. Those things can trigger drug-induced lupus. And then don't forget isoniazid. Again, they can make a TB question from this. Don't forget procainamide. We use it for WPW, right? Remember, WPW is a supraventricular tachyarrhythmia, right? So all those things, right? Etanercept, right? So they can tell you about a person that was placed on some kind of TNF inhibitor, right? All these things can absolutely trigger drug-induced lupus, right? And high yield things to know, because some people ask, oh, Divine, how do I differentiate between drug-induced lupus and regular lupus? Well, the thing is, the antibodies will really help you here, right? So people that have drug-induced lupus, they don't have anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies. They don't have low complement, right? They don't have low complement. And many of these like really bad things that happen with lupus, like lupus affecting the brain or lupus affecting the kidneys, pretty much does not happen in these people. And for the most part, these people don't need actual treatment. Just stop the offending agent and the problem will disappear, right? That is the primary treatment for drug-induced lupus. Just stop the offending agent, problem will go away. That's pretty much it, right? And again, I know I just said that lupus, again, tends to cause these brain findings. Again, many times the brain findings are going to be like strokes, right? They're going to be like, like venous thromboembolic disease of the brain, right? Like strokes and things like that. Why? Because, again, that inflammation can cause thrombosis, right? That inflammation can cause thrombosis. Because remember, whenever you have a lot of inflammation, you can expose subendothelial collagen, and that can trigger the coagulation cascade and ultimately cause problems, right? So in general, I guess, so maybe as I begin to wrap up, how do we diagnose lupus, right? So many times you're going to diagnose lupus by getting the ANA, right? You're going to screen for lupus by getting ANA. Basically, ANA, remember in medicine, whenever we're trying to diagnose some kind of disease, when we start with a screening test, right? The screening test, we want it to be a highly sensitive test, right? Because we want to rule out disease, right? But then after that, we need to confirm, right? We do that with a confirmatory test. That's going to be a test of high specificity, right? So like ANA, for example, is very sensitive for lupus, right? It's very sensitive. If a person's ANA is negative, the chances of them having lupus on an MBM exam is pretty much zero, right? But the problem though is any is sensitive. So it's your screening test. But the thing is, any is positive in many other disorders. Any is positive in scleroderma. Any is positive in about 70% of patients that have a Sjogren's, right? So it's not specific for anything, but it's sensitive. It will help you capture all the people that have lupus. So how do you confirm that a person has lupus? Well, you're going to confirm by checking the anti-double-stranded DNA or the anti-Smith antibodies. That's very high yield to know, right? The anti-double-stranded DNA or the anti-Smith antibodies. And the anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies are like almost like 100% specific for lupus. The anti-Smith antibodies are almost like 100% specific for lupus as well. I think the anti-Smith antibodies kind of win off a bit, but for the most part, they're pretty much almost like 100% sensitive, specific, in both cases, right? So that's why those are your confirmatory tests. And it's very important to know that the antibody that many times tracks along with disease activity are your anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, right? Your anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies. And again, don't forget, lupus, you know, we can treat it in a variety of ways, right? So we can treat it with like hydroxychloroquine, for example. Hydroxychloroquine is probably like a pretty good drug to use to treat lupus on MBM exams. Now, one thing I want to make you know / keep in mind for the USMLE purposes is that hydroxychloroquine is great, but you need to screen those people with like an eye exam every year, right? Because hydroxychloroquine can cause this retinopathy, right? It can damage the retinal pigmented epithelium. So those people in general need annual eye exams. That's a nice high yield preventive medicine question our friends at the MBME love to test. Another thing you should keep in mind, since I'm just talking about the retinal pigmented epithelium, is actually also high yield to know that people that have, because I remember this from the podcast I made yesterday, for some reason I just forgot to mention it, but people that have familial adenomatous polyposis, right? Familial adenomatous polyposis. One clue, it's an unusual clue, but when it shows up, it's very helpful to know. One clue that can guide you in that direction on MBM exams is, if you notice a person and they seem to have like, they were either born with this or they, you know, they seem to have this congenitally, where they have like hypertrophy of the retinal pigmented epithelium. I'll say that again, hypertrophy of the retinal pigmented epithelium. That is a relatively specific finding in people that have familial adenomatous polyposis. Remember, that arises from an APC gene mutation. And then, you know, if let's say you've tried hydroxychloroquine and it doesn't do squat for the patient, well, what do you need to do? Well, you need to do steroids, right? And remember, steroids, many times you use them to also treat like exacerbations of lupus. Whenever you have an acute worsening of symptoms in an autoimmune disease, many times you want to give like large doses of steroids to kind of calm things down. And then let's assume those steroids don't work. Well, obviously, the thing you're going to be going to after that is going to be a TNF inhibitor, something like adalimumab. You know, maybe giving those people etanercept is not the most genius idea in the world, given as etanercept also causes a drug-induced lupus. So I think those are kind of like the big things I want to mention, the big things I want to talk about. And hopefully you all find this to be helpful. Again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one to step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams, even these are Caribbean med students that are studying for their comp exams. I do offer tutoring for those. And then I have these review courses for step two, CK, step three, complex level two and three that I you know, happen roughly every month. And then I do help with ERAS applications, personal statements, rec letters, especially with editing those things. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email and I'll be more than happy to, you know, give you my list of prices and we can kind of take things from there. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify, at least the most recent 150. And then I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. If you go on that YouTube channel, you'll find all the videos that I have made. They're on there. And then I do have the website, right? DivineInterventionPodcast.com. Whenever you go on that website, you know, if you subscribe, whenever I make a new podcast, you will get an email notification. And then many people have said that, wow, Divine, I really love your Life Lessons podcast, right? I really, really love your Life Lessons podcast. So I did actually start a new website like a few weeks ago. It's called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. I actually do, you know, make a podcast, like, you know, two podcasts or thereabouts every week. And they're all 10 minutes or less. And those podcasts, they just emphasize some Bible-based life lesson, right? That, again, I've gotten emails from people that are like, wow, Divine, thank you for making these podcasts. I found them to be helpful. And actually, that podcast is actually on Apple Podcasts, right? It's called Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So if you look at that, I think you should be able to get some good information from there. Now, one thing I guess I want to go ahead and say, maybe like my life lesson for today that I'll just throw in with this podcast, is just the importance of service, right? The importance of service. Again, many people just feel that And I think it's a problem that's especially pervasive with our current generation, that everything must be handed down to them, right? Everything must be done for them, right? Like no personal sense of responsibility, right? And the thing is, when you have no personal sense of responsibility, you're pretty much damaging your life. That's just the truth, right? The thing is, you're not on this earth to be served. No. You're on this earth to serve other people. The thing is, you'll notice that your life gets a lot fuller, a lot more fulfilling when you actually spend your time serving people, right? If you're always, because life is about give and take, right? And even the Bible says that it is more blessed to give than to receive. Basically, the Bible there is saying that it's more blessed to serve than to be served, right? But the thing is, people have this mindset that no. Everything must be done for me. This person must do this for me. That person must do this for me. That's why you see many friendships are based on how much you can get from the other member of that friendship, right? The thing is, whenever you have friends like that, those are very shallow friends. I'm not saying those people cannot be your friends, but there's a big difference between having friends and having an inner circle. Those people should absolutely not be your close friends. They shouldn't be people you confide in, right? Because the thing is, people like that, the moment your wealth or whatever help you're arranging to them goes away, those people stop being your friends, right? But the Bible says that there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. This is a friend that is willing to serve, right? So the thing is, have that mindset of service, right? Ask yourself, how are you serving the world around you? Right? Because the thing is, again, I'm telling you, your life just gets like literally from making this podcast alone or from making the videos that I make, I get a lot of fulfillment in my life. Right? Again, these podcasts, like, you know, is it like a paid service or whatever? No. But do I feel great doing this? Absolutely. Right? My morning has been brightened literally by just making these podcasts. So again, I will encourage you, live a life of service. Live a life of service. Don't be a friend to people because you always want to mooch off of them. No, be a friend to people because you want to serve them, right? When you serve people, again, you are creating good networks, good connections, and you're just making the world a better place. So thank you for listening to me. I'll see you in the next episode. God bless you. Thank you.